If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. For too long, Indigenous people have been marginalised or viewed merely as passive participants in the history of the United States. That's one of the arguments Ned Blackhawk makes in his sweeping new account, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of US History. Ned spoke to Matt Elton about how Native Americans played key roles in everything from the course of European colonisation to 20th century bids for equality and self-determination.
I'm joined today by Ned Blackhawk to talk about his book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of US History, which is a really expansive, comprehensive sort of reimagining of US history. Before we get into some of the particular historical episodes you explore in the book, I wanted to talk a bit about some of the verbs in the title there, because we've got rediscovery and we've got unmaking. And I wondered how central those ideas were in the writing of this book.
The term rediscovery and unmaking may seem potentially as somewhat oppositional and or contested bedfellows, so to speak. But I think as the introduction kind of establishes, there's a series of labor or work that needs to be done to really move American historical inquiry into really the 21st century more fully. And that is to kind of discard some of the interpretive tools that have kind of structured American historical inquiry throughout much of its history and or particularly throughout the late 20th century, and to reimagine or rediscover the subject matter in new and exciting ways. So I'm simultaneously kind of suggesting that we unmake some of our temporal, spatial, and kind of binary racial paradigms and to try to rediscover the heterogeneity and diversity that is at the core of North America's historical experience.
It also seems important to give Native peoples an active role in this story. Do you think there's been a tendency in scholarship, in history, to sort of flatten these stories or to tell the stories only in one certain way?
I do. And you're picking up on a really unfortunate theme and kind of paradigm of American historical study, and that is the either one-dimensionality or the ahistorical kind of homogenization of the diversity of Native America, both historically and contemporarily speaking. And so this book is attempting to give a kind of broad, multi-century overview of the particularly contiguous continental U.S. historical narrative, and to place indigenous agency and historical development at the core of these centuries' historical developments. So, and as you or many of your listeners may know, Native peoples have been not just written out of history, but presumed to have limited either cultural, intellectual, or kind of social capacities for much of the last many centuries of European and North American intellectual history. These are the kind of quintessential peoples without history, according to Hegel, or peoples caught in the kind of primitive form of naturalization, according to kind of countless anthropologists.
Heading back then to explore some of the historical episodes you cover in the book, you write that European contact sent shockwaves across Indigenous homelands, reverberating in many forms, some of them undocumented. I thought it would be really good to sort of unpick that a bit. What were some of the ways in which Native people felt these shockwaves?
Really, from the first months of the Spanish encounter in the Caribbean, following Columbus's first and subsequent voyages, throughout the 1500s and the exploration of Floridian panhandle into the American Southeast, across the central Mexican Nahua or Aztec kingdom, into northern Mexico and into what is now the American Southwest, European intrusions radically disrupted indigenous economies, lifeways, and particularly kind of demographic horizons through the introduction of various new forms of violence, enslavement, and most notably diseases. So really, you can't tell the history of the United States or the history of North America outside of these disruptions, these reverberations, these shockwaves, these kind of expanding spheres of disruption. That's not to say Native peoples were entirely displaced or disrupted by these waves of turbulence, but the sentence that you quoted from is from a part of the study that's really trying to ground these subjects at the heart of particularly regional analyses of early American history.
How common was violence across these diverse experiences?
You know, I'm somewhat of a, I don't want to say polarizing figure in this subject, but I do have a certain degree of potential, perhaps infamy in certain scholarly circles for some claims that I overemphasize the degree of violence that Europeans brought. Many anthropologists, archaeologists, and other what are known as ethnohistorians have kind of taken some caution to some of my suggestions in my earlier works about the prevalence of what I call pandemic relations of violence. I'm actually glad that you asked that, because this work is not inherently about the violent nature of European colonialism, though that's a central theme. And it now invites me to kind of meditate back and reflect on some of these earlier themes that were in my first book called Violence Over the Land. If you look at particularly like Chapter 3, which is on the formation of New France, as it's known, or and centers on French and Iroquois Confederacy relations across the 1600s, you see this theme, and the chapter is entitled The Unpredictability of Violence, which draws from Hannah Arendt's kind of famous studies on violence and the kind of theories of the centrality of violence to political formations. If you look at that chapter, you see very clearly that prior to French arrival and settlement in 1609 along the St. Lawrence Seaway, indigenous populations did not make war upon each other in the ways that they subsequently learned how to do. They lacked, obviously, guns and metal arms. They lacked defensive types of armory or kind of weaponry that they would eventually try to develop. And perhaps most notably, they lacked the motivation to maraud and subjugate kind of distant territories and populations, which the Iroquois, among others, began doing in very, very dramatic form throughout the 1600s. And so there's an image from Champlain's first kind of confront military confrontation with Mohawk warriors outside of what is now Lake Champlain, New York. And these communities are kind of engaged in various types of what we might call more ritualized forms of combat. Groups of combating or antagonistic soldiers or warriors would gather in a kind of pre-disclosed or determined location, surround one another throughout the night, lodge insults and, you know, various types of verbal barbs at one another, and then gather the next day for a form of combat that conceivably might have some degrees of casualties and violent repercussions. None of that is commensurate with what becomes the dominant form of military conflict throughout this region in the late and 1600s, mid to late 1600s, and throughout the century thereafter, including theaters of both the Seven Years' War and the American Revolution.
One of the things that your book does is to try to centralize the experiences of Native people against a wider backdrop of what was happening during this vast history. What were the ways in which, we've talked about some of the idea of shockwaves, did these shockwaves extend back towards Europe, towards the people coming to America from Europe?
They did. And that's another kind of prominent theme of, if I can be so presumptive, of my collective studies so far in Native North American history, because these shockwaves, which were often unrecorded by Europeans, reverberated far beyond these actual scenes of encounter or far beyond the actual settlements of Europeans in the Southwest. Famously, the introduction of Spanish horses and various equestrian technologies spread widely across the North American plains beginning in the mid to late 1600s. In the Northeast, both Dutch and French technologies of violence like guns and metals spread across much of Eastern North America. And indigenous populations trade, incorporate, adapt, and reconfigure particularly many of their military practices, and subsequently in the plains, their technologies of travel and pastoralism to incorporate these new wondrous materials, thereby enhancing many of their capabilities, and thereby often punishing or diminishing or kind of recalibrating the anticipated power of Europeans. And so one of the central themes of Native American history of the colonial era of the last generation or so has been a kind of recognition of the inherently non-asymmetrical nature of imperialism, so to speak, the kind of centrality of indigenous peoples to the making of early America through their power, through their trade, through their social and diplomatic relations, through their incorporation of Europeans into their kinship and village social societies. A kind of a constellation of insights have essentially been offered by this generation of scholars whom I'm drawing upon. So the Rediscovery of America, as the title, is not just a kind of an invitation for all of us as American or North American citizens and inhabitants to rethink our continent's history, but it's also a kind of recognition that the American historical experience has been heavily rediscovered by more than a generation of scholars to whom I'm incredibly indebted.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And we'll talk about some of the activism a bit later on. I'm calling today from England. I thought it would be remiss to not ask about the specific impact this story had on England's colonial ambitions, if any.
Yeah, one of my favorite chapters is on the kind of paradoxical outcome of the Seven Years' War in North America. I presume most British citizens are more familiar with British history sometimes than than Americans. But most of my students, most of my friends, neighbors and family members have never really heard about the Seven Years' War, often called the French and Indian War in North America. I am a product of a Canadian educational system for my undergraduate degree. So I was around buildings named after British royal leaders from this period. But generally speaking, very few Americans know that the first real global conflict of the 18th century, and according to some scholars, the most important military conflict of the 18th century is the Seven Years' War, which breaks out in the interior of North America with a kind of failed colonial expedition led by George Washington against some increasingly fortified French forces and kind of fortifications along the Ohio River. And this kind of war spreads like mushrooms kind of unexpectedly across much of the Atlantic and even the Mediterranean. They're South Asia. There's a battle in Manila, you know, because France and later Spain kind of confront England and this kind of global kind of a slugfest that ultimately erodes France's North American empire at the Treaty of Paris in, I think, February of 1763, whereby France transfers all of its North American possessions, which predate English colonization largely, to the victorious British crown under, I think, parliamentary leader William Pitt. And so all of a sudden, in 1763, in the early years, Britain has inherited this massive empire and has just concluded the world's most successful global conflict. And so how does this empire, which seemingly has become so profoundly and unexpectedly powerful, lose control of not just its transferred territory from New France, but much of it? It will retain, as your listeners may know, much of Canada, called Upper and East, Lower Canada after the American Revolution. But how does England essentially lose its vast kind of American possessions, or many of them? And so I kind of think, as do many in my field, that you can't really tell the narrative of American independence outside of not just the conflict, obviously, with England, but the kind of multipolar, multi-imperial, and indigenous world of the Seven Years' War and its aftermath. And so there's a lot in chapters 4, 5, and 6 about this interior world and the kind of many deep ironies and paradoxes that ultimately bred American independence.
So did this feed into or precipitate the American Revolution? Can we say that?
I can, and I do, and we can, and we should, because the first shots against English soldiers fired in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War are fired in western Pennsylvania against British troops who are protecting overland British traders. I mean, these are all British subjects at the time. But the revolutionaries are, there's a series of what I call settler militias that have formed in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War. And why they're so concerned, and it's a little technical, again, it involves a military conflict that very few people have heard of called Pontiac's War, which erupts in the fall of 1763, or in the summer, I'm sorry, of 1763. And it's followed by the proclamation, or the Royal Proclamation of 1763 in October. So three monumental things happened in 1763. I think it's February, the Treaty of Paris, or at least news of the Treaty of Paris arrives to North America. B, the interior native peoples who have been kind of left out of the negotiations between France and England essentially confront British imperial rule militarily and politically and defiantly, and they burn 9 of the 13 forts that the British have inherited from the French across what I call the Native Inland Sea, or what others have called the Native Inland Sea, which are the five Great Lakes of interior North America, from which both the Mississippi and the St. Lawrence both flow, and the kind of constitutes the kind of nautical heartland of the continent. So the indigenous populations are not going to simply accept British dominion, having not really lost any wars of their own during the Seven Years' War. And so they launch a kind of series of unexpected campaigns called Pontiac's War, and they destabilize British imperial rule, making peace essentially more costly than war itself. And in the aftermath, the British crown establishes this proclamation and also begins establishing diplomatic and economic and various types of social commitments to interior indigenous peoples that outrages Western British settlers, who feel like now that the war is over, the interior should become theirs. And so overland trading supplies and kind of pack trains of goods that are heading to kind of lube the wheels of diplomatic negotiations essentially are marauded by various sets of settler militias, some of whom have already targeted and killed Indian villages whom they suspect to be allied with the interior native, Pontiac's interior native forces. So it's a really kind of complex aftermath that has been, in my mind, completely or almost entirely excised from the kind of traditional narrative on the origins of the revolution. It's perhaps helpful to know that there are very few large American cities in 1863, 1864, 1865. Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Charleston. These are very small towns by our contemporary standards. None has more than 20,000 people at the time. And so somehow the narrative of the colony's future and its kind of deliberations always focuses on these relatively small seaports, when the vast preponderance of British settlers, there's 1.5 million or so in 1750, live in farming, agricultural, and often interior spaces. And in these interior spaces, their concerns about indigenous peoples are paramount, and much more they're much more concerned about British relations with interior Indians than they are tea or stamp taxes that are being imposed in the urban merchant classes. And so it's not unsurprising, for example, that these Western Pennsylvania rebels, as one scholar calls them, are articulating a particularly revolutionary discourse that is not only anti-imperial, it's also very anti-indigenous, we might call it, where they have a deep, like seated animosity because of this previous war that they'd gone through, in which indigenous combatants were often the vast preponderance of French allies and fighting forces. There were raids and captive experiences that were pretty common in many Western New York or Western Pennsylvania, Western Virginia type of settlements. And so it's not, so this discourse that is revolutionary is not just anti-monarchical or anti-imperial, it's also anti-elite, it's anti-aristocratic. People like Benjamin Franklin are initially held in suspicion by Western Pennsylvania settler citizens as they increasingly become seen as. And it's not unsurprising that this discourse of anti-indigeneity makes it into the Declaration of Independence, which complains about the British Crown's not just various forms of usurpations of power, but also how it has somehow incited what they call merciless Indian savages to attack our frontier community. So the term frontier and merciless Indian savages, or those terms, are, I think, a direct kind of, their antecedents are found in these interior indigenous conflicts that, by and large, most revolutionary historians have been unable to bring into the kind of conventional narrative. And so as we approach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, myself and some others are really trying to foreground these historical experiences in order to really rediscover American history, so to speak.
That's so interesting. Your book also explores two other things that I think perhaps people in Britain may not have heard of. I certainly wasn't that familiar with them, which is Jay's Treaty and the Louisiana Purchase. Could you just explain the importance of those two things?
What we just discussed really concerns the events leading up to the Revolution. In the aftermath of the Revolution, a series of also really dramatic and transformative deliberations unfold. And it's not incoincidental that in 1783, when the Second Treaty of Paris recognizes American independence, that British Crown and Parliament are agreeing to, that England continues to station its soldiers at various North American forts. England has retained essentially what we would call Eastern Canada, the Hudson's Bay, its Caribbean island holdings, Eastern Canadian forts like Louisbourg. But it also keeps its soldiers at places like Niagara and Detroit, in a place called Michilimackinac, which is in northern Michigan. And there's a little ambiguity in the aftermath of the American independence. Not a little, there's a tremendous amount of ambiguity. And many believe that this political experiment is doomed to fail. And so the interior will remain a contested, undetermined battle borderlands that will become a battleground in the War of 1812, when England and the United States will again go to war to determine essentially the future of these portions of North America. But in the interim, between 1783 and, say, 1812, the United States reconstitutes itself in 1787 abandoning its first governing structure called the Articles of Confederation. This is like technical U.S. civics type of historical subject matter that most American high school students hear and forget about very, very quickly. And very few American college students ever spend time learning about the Articles of Confederation because they failed. And as is, I think, well understood, American historical inquiry has often celebrated rather than, I don't want to say vilified, but American historians have often approached American historical development in a celebratory or somewhat we would call exceptionalistic paradigm or frame. And so American failures are not the kind of subject matter of many studies or courses. But the Articles essentially are unable to govern the 13 independent states. And the federal government is formed in much greater and stronger capacity following the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Now, why is this really important? Because this experiment, this incredibly radical new polity, envisions a future for itself that it is ultimately not able to fully actualize. And the biggest failure in American history, at least by historical standards, is the Civil War. And so we kind of lose sight of the fact, if we think of the Civil War as an inevitable conflict, of how the federal government actually tries to solve many of its initial problems. And Indian affairs are one of the few areas in which most settlers or state leaders agree should be the exclusive domain of the federal government. Why is that important? It's because it's not only lodged into the Constitution as a supreme right of the federal government, but the federal government's infrastructure for dealing with Indians actually enables it to do other things. Jay's Treaty and the Louisiana Purchase Treaty of 1803 are examples of how issues around Indian affairs come to shape American foreign policy determinations and deliberations. And so Jay's Treaty is the first formal international treaty that the United States enters into with European powers, conducted and concluded in the fall of 1794. It has provisions about trade between England and the United States. It has provisions about Britain essentially abandoning its loyalties to indigenous peoples within the boundaries of the United States, and also allowing for the free passage of native peoples between the two realms. And it's followed very shortly thereafter by both a military victory by the United States against interior native peoples, as well as a subsequent treaty called Greenville that really kind of solidifies U.S. authority across what is now the Ohio, state of Ohio. So Jay's Treaty can't be or shouldn't be read as an exclusively Anglo-American diplomatic outcome, but one in which indigenous, not just affairs are involved, but the process of making treaties is one of the first and only forms of essentially foreign policy power that the federal government has already done, both during the period of the Articles and then during the Constitution. So I think the first six or seven treaties that the Senate in the United States ratifies are all with Indian groups. And so in that process of learning how to make treaties with Indians, the federal government essentially learns how to make treaties with other people. There's a scholar named Margot Kennedy who has a very interesting book about how American power, essentially state power, is often, how it's often established through various forms of puzzling before power is essentially implemented. So essentially the federal government puzzles around Indian affairs in order, or subsequently in order to power through other treaty relationships, both with England and then more famously with France in the Louisiana Purchase Treaty of 1803.
This is obviously a hugely whistle-stop tour through centuries of American history. We should talk about the American Civil War. I think I'm right in saying that you write that there were groups of indigenous people who were the first casualties, the first victims of this conflict. Is that right?
The first casualties of federally subsidized units of the Civil War are California Indians killed in the spring of 1861 who are receiving federal funding for the first time They previously received state funding. So these are not necessarily these are not campaigns of the Civil War. These are ongoing campaigns in California. But I make that kind of point to kind of denaturalize or recenter the struggle for North America, essentially, at the heart of the Civil War era, because the outcome of this conflict will reverberate, obviously, profoundly across the continent. And it has been largely told as a story and struggle between the North and the South, which it was, as a kind of political crisis. Seven states of the American Union initially agreed to secede and form their own country called the Confederate States of America. And they had a very different political vision and political economy and kind of set of ideological and diplomatic practices that they wanted to establish. So my effort here is to try to intervene a bit into the kind of conventional narrative of the coming and the course of the Civil War in order to show that it both had Western antecedents and it had very powerful Western legacies. You may not have been intentionally using a kind of what would we call a rail metaphor of whistle stops, but there are kind of scenes in these chapters about the transformative impact the railroad in particular has across the 1860s. And very few people would really come to understand this, but prior to the Civil War, most of what we recognize to be the kind of modern structures of American political, technological, and even perhaps economic life did not kind of operate the way they do currently. And my chapter on the Civil War opens with the Colorado Gold Rush, when tens of thousands of overland migrants are heading to the Rocky Mountains, and they're all coming by horse, essentially, or cattle or oxen. And so animals, I write, drive the heart of overland travel before the Civil War. And Lincoln himself, when he's campaigning in 1860, will have to take, I think, four or five different trains to get to New York City for a famous address he gives at Cooper Union in February of 1860, because he's traveling across different regional railway systems that use different track sizes or gauge sizes. And so he has to take a steamboat across one river and then down another, and then he's on all these different trains. It takes him 4 or 5 days to get to New York. By the end of the war, after his assassination, he travels by one railway system from Washington back to Illinois. It travels at 5 miles an hour so that anyone and everyone can come and witness the kind of solemnity of his long burial kind of procession. And so that metaphor, that those images, which are drawn from kind of famous studies of these subjects, really kind of resonated with me that the train didn't really exist. Not only not on a continental scale, it didn't really exist even on a national scale in the United States in the ways that it would become so dominant thereafter.
I would love to claim credit for doing that intentionally, but I absolutely do not. I wanted to talk to you about the years immediately after the Civil War. Was this a period in which the state started to exercise new control and new authority over indigenous groups?
Yes, and upon all really subjects of the Union. These are, of course, a vast and deeply well-researched subjects, many of them. And the intent of this project is to try to bring together many kind of conventional narratives of the United States and assess them from the perspective of Native American communities. And so there's also this kind of not just the railway transformations that we just detailed, but the particularly growth of the federal government from 1860 to 1865, 1870, is just astronomically transformative. There are some scholars who say most American citizens would never have seen a representative of the American government before the Civil War. Maybe a governor or a territorial leader periodically, but hardly ever a military officer, a government employee, maybe a federal postal service member. But after the war, the government is just becoming a behemoth, what we call the administrative state. And so the federal government's power and authority kind of flow in kind of waves throughout the war itself. And then during Reconstruction, which is this 13-year period or so from the end of the war to 1877, when the federal government still occupies the South with its Union Army and attempts a series of Reconstruction amendments and reforms to essentially integrate former slaves into the American political and social and economic fabric of the nation. It's also doing a lot of things in the West. And so the federal government eventually will become the banker, the manager, the educator or teacher, the doctor. It will essentially run all of these divisions and departments of what we would call reservation Indian life across the post-war era. And so much of the period of Reconstruction or the aftermath of the U.S. Civil War is incorporating indigenous peoples in the West and their lands and resources into the body politic of the United States, using the railway to relocate Nez Perce Indians from Idaho and the interior Northwest, using the railway to bring Apache or Modoc combatants from Northern California or Southern Arizona, bringing indigenous peoples concentrated forms in places like Oklahoma, or establishing reservations through the treaty process, some of which are vast and full of resources and in addition to lands. It's an incredibly transformative period of growth as well as diminishment, because one of the real tragedies of American Indian policy is that many of the initial efforts by the federal government to build autonomous, self-sufficient protectorates and or enclaves within the body politic of the United States fall under the purview of various social reformers in the late 19th century who attempt to erode them by bringing children away from their communities to be educated in military-style pedagogical institutions like the Carlisle Indian Institute, subdividing reservation land holdings, attempting to impose religious and or normative Euro-American gender conventions onto Native populations. These practices, known as assimilation, constitute roughly a half century of American Indian policy at the end of Reconstruction.
One fact that really struck me was that Native peoples were not granted U.S. citizenship until 1924. Was this all Native people? And what did this mean? Were there new rights granted at this point?
That is correct. It was not until 1924, in the aftermath of the First World War, that American Indians became universally eligible for U.S. citizenship. There were efforts in that kind of half century of assimilation that I mentioned beforehand to bring the vote or the franchise or various enticements of citizenship to Native peoples living in reservation and or rural communities, encouraging them essentially to abandon their loyalties or affinities to tribal communities in exchange for private property, political participation, and other potential rights like serving on juries and or as eligible elected officials. It is an incredibly complex kind of legality to it that would require some understanding that many tribal community members never really aspired to become U.S. citizens. And so it was an imposition of sorts as well, that citizenship became essentially a necessary legality for the federal government to eventually grant citizenship to Native Americans so that various complex questions around border travel or criminal jurisdictions around criminal laws, various types of everyday kind of political practices could be institutionalized. And one of the recurring themes of the 20th century throughout Native America has been an attempt to ensure that the political distinctiveness of Native American communities not be extinguished by these assimilative kind of incorporative legal efforts.
We've obviously talked about some huge themes, some huge episodes. One thing I wanted to make sure that I didn't do in my questions is sort of smudge or ignore any distinctiveness or diversity. Are there any stories of particular groups or I suppose even individuals in the 20th century that you think help us make sense of that story?
Thank you for that question. It is really hard in this kind of broad, sweeping either conversation or even scholarly effort to not lose sight of just either the distinctiveness of communities themselves and or of individuals grappling with very sometimes overwhelming and seemingly impossible challenges. And so the last two chapters of the book, which are largely about the 20th century, attempt to bring more Indigenous voices and more Indigenous kind of biographies and or kind of leadership, studies of leadership into these eras, and to highlight what we would call the kind of political agency, activism, and intelligence of Native communities who and individuals who are navigating incredibly dire and difficult circumstances. And it's not really hard to find individuals or communities in Native North America today whose parents or grandparents or even themselves have struggled in ways to find consistent forms of employment or maintain social and ceremonial and or kind of cultural connections to communities. The federal government has been trying to essentially assimilate and disaggregate Native communities for much of its history. And in the late 20th century, there was this policy known as termination and relocation that occurred throughout the Cold War era, where the federal government was incentivizing American Indians to leave their communities, to migrate to cities, and essentially abandon their kind of political loyalties and to their sovereign communities at home. So how people have kind of responded to these challenges is really, for me, quite revealing and in many ways inspirational. And the antecedents are not just in the more familiar forms of activism, which there are many examples of in Native America, but they are found on reservations and in small educational efforts and artistic communities in Santa Fe. And so I try to highlight a series of them. And what are the ones that are most kind of appealing to me or enduring? I take some particular inspiration by a very small group of Native American political and educational intellectual leaders who formed a society in 1911 called the Society of American Indians, which is the first national intertribal political advocacy group in Native American history. And it included initially a small number of boarding school educated Indian leaders, including Laura Cornelius Kellogg, who is an Oneida Indian leader who had a particularly defiant and articulate and determined kind of political philosophy that seemingly was not going to be forestalled by various either government or non-government efforts. These are individuals who understood that the United States was becoming so powerful, so populous, and so kind of historically unconscious, essentially, that they had to create narratives of history that counteracted them. And so many Native American intellectuals are in many ways are historians kind of almost by necessity and talk not only of their own community's history, but of other Native peoples whose history has been written out of the kind of political and national narrative. And so they're critiquing these paradigms of disappearance and of cultural racism and various kind of presumptions about their inferiority by showing how educated and capable and politically astute they are. And so they form political associations, they lobby Congress, they publish newsletters, they form a small group of them, including the first Yale-trained Native American, the first graduate of Yale University, Henry Rocloud, who's a Ho-Chunk Indian from Nebraska. They formed their own educational institute to train Indians differently than the boarding schools. And they are widely successful in their efforts over time. I mean, their kind of political activism has not been sufficiently recognized in much of even the narrative of American Indian political activist history, because it focused so much on the kind of more militant, often, you know, revolutionary efforts to reoccupy buildings and lands in the post-war era.
What more work do you think needs to be done in popular re-understandings of the place of Indigenous people in the United States history?
Well, I believe that you really can't understand the history of North America without its original inhabitants. And the edifices and monuments and kind of institutionalization of American historical inquiry and consciousness have largely done so or attempted to do so. And so there is this kind of almost apparition that has kind of formed and come into recognition in the last generation or two. I say that there's a question, these questions haunt America. And we have to kind of understand that our historical consciousness needs to be unmade in order for us to really peer through these clouds of misunderstanding that have been kind of pervaded by popular culture and or fanciful, mythic kind of narratives in order to see a more sobering but realistic portrait of the continent's history. Indigenous history, ironically, having been so marginal and so kind of erased or ignored for so long, it almost provides one of the clearest counter-narratives to American history from a contact to the present, in that these themes of perseverance and survival and adaptation and political advocacy and kind of legal activism constitute an alternative corpus, essentially, of American historical formation that is nonetheless similarly national and revealing. And one of the great kind of legal ironies is that Native Americans have understood that despite all of its problems, the kind of doctrine of Native American sovereignty that the federal government has kind of reluctantly come to articulate and establish is one of the few unifying kind of political opportunities or forms of recognition that all Native peoples who are recognized by the federal government can similarly occupy. So despite the diversity, there's a kind of uniform kind of national experience or a story that can be told if one kind of is able to look past these clouds or these kind of sedimented forms of calcified knowledge and to see anew an alternative understanding of America.
That was Professor Ned Blackhawk. The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of US History is out now, published by Yale University Press. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.